Iran will be introduced as an accepted member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in the first upcoming meeting. This was an example of the parliament's role-playing. Of course, we noticed the general political approach of the parliament, particularly in the 11th term. The parliament considers itself to be a supporter of national interests. The representatives consider themselves to be the ones who should follow the interests of the people and international cooperation, particularly with Asian and Eurasian countries. Those that do not have a hegemonic position has been received in the general view of the 11th legislature. This was also among the programs presented by the foreign minister to the 11th legislature, and the parliament, by voting for the foreign minister, actually approved the presented program, of which this program is part of.
Excuse me, just to clarify for our international audience. So, like in many countries, also in Iran, whatever minister wants to become minister is being presented by the government to become minister has to be approved by the parliament. So there's never a foreign minister in Iran that doesn't have the approval of the parliament.
It's true. The MPs must give a vote of confidence to all ministers. In fact, they should trust both the personal competence of those who are suited for this position and their presented program. In particular, the Minister of Foreign Affairs goes through the same process. All our foreign ministers have gone through the same process, and this was also the case for our recent minister, Dr. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, and both his competence and program were approved with high numbers of votes in favor. But the parliament also has the possibility to observe the work process. In other words, it invites the ministers and their deputies to participate in the parliament commission's meetings and fractions in the form of discussion and exchange of opinions. It listens to the opinions and exchanges the latest info. But if it wants to receive an official answer, or if there is any ambiguity or criticism, it'll use tools such as notice, query, or impeachment, which are the representative's tools, to get an official answer from a minister. Therefore, our parliament is also involved in selecting people in the field of foreign policy. Of course, for us, this trust only exists regarding the ministers. I've seen that some countries have the same rules regarding ambassadors. We have dialogue sessions with ambassadors, but their appointment and selection is not a matter that is done by the Majlis. It is the duty of the executive branch. Regarding the international documents that I said we confirm, maybe more than 10 international documents are approved in the parliament almost every year. Some of these are bilateral. A clear example: recently, we approved a document that allows our government to exchange Iranian and Belgian prisoners between the two governments of Iran and Belgium. We have this exchange of convicts with many countries. And this is one of the documents that the government cannot implement without the permission of the parliament. Our bilateral cooperation, documents related to our cooperation commitments with different countries, these are also part of this. And the international example of it is Iran's accession to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. There are other discussions about new organizations in this regard. You mentioned Iran's membership of BRICS. Well, BRICS is one of the topics that the parliament is interested in. It means an institution that is trying to develop multilateralism in the international arena, and there are countries that do not follow the American hegemonic position. They are looking for alternative ways for economic cooperation. This is an issue that is currently being pursued by our government. Surely, if it achieves an international document, a document is signed between our government and the member countries of BRICS and its secretariat, this document must be presented to the parliament again. We have not yet reached this stage, but as I said, the Iranian parliament agrees with this approach. Of course, there are details regarding the processing of documents that they will be examined when the documents are ready.
I have a question here, because one thing that we're witnessing in the global scene currently, which is related to BRICS, which is related to the rise of new powers, of new economic powers. We had a very interesting interview with the Deputy Foreign Minister for Economic Affairs, Dr. Safari, is the idea that the world is moving away from the dollar, from the U.S. dollar, and this hegemonic currency is no longer in the position that it is. Of course, we see that in Iran, we still are valuing some of the budget and are planning based on the dollar income that we have from oil. But we see that the world is moving towards replacing the dollar. Of course, Iran being one of the countries that's very prominent in trying to do this. If you could please give us a little information and some insight into what it is from the perspective of the parliament that can be done or is being done to move this process of de-dollarization further for Iran.
Yes, the issue of the dollar's role in stabilizing America's hegemony is a serious matter in the international system. That is, the dollar is definitely one of the effective tools that the U.S. uses to exercise its dominance. The U.S. is somehow spreading its own economic problems and its budget deficit to all parts of the world by using the dollar, and it is distancing itself from this issue, and even uses this tool as a weapon. They unilaterally sanction a country like us in using this international currency. That is why we have changes in some of our transactions with currencies in countries of the world that are depending on the dollar. A famous instance of which is Iran's frozen assets in South Korea. Well, there are some problems in order to access them due to Korea's own dependence on the U.S. dollar, and we think that the United States is actually projecting and expanding its own unilateral laws and border laws beyond its own borders. And for this reason, an acceptable criticism by international researchers is that the U.S. uses its own tools to exercise dominance, and the dollar is one of them. Therefore, Iran's Majlis definitely supports the fact to distance our foreign trade from the dollar. One of the instances that we pursue this issue is supporting bilateral and multilateral agreements with different countries, both in the economic and the national security commissions. We are among the encouraging institutions of our government. The financial department of the government, our central bank, and the Ministry of Economy enters into dialogue and interaction with countries with which we have trade. Well, most of our trade is with China, the UAE, and Iraq. We can use part of our bilateral needs through local currencies. We support this idea in this framework, and one of our demands from our government officials has always been to pay attention to the issue of national currencies in discussions with countries to strengthen international trade. Creating clearing and settlement mechanisms that are formed in trade between two countries, all of those are tools that we think by strengthening them, we can distance ourselves from using the dollar and at the same time create opportunities for Iran's international trade. It is undeniable that the Americans are applying one of the most severe sanctions regimes against Iran. But Iran is at a stage where our international trade exceeded $130 billion last year. This is an amazing figure for those who are not familiar with our economic system and activities. And in this path, we definitely welcome the increase in bilateral cooperation with national and local currencies. The idea of using local currencies is one of the plans that the Islamic Republic is proposing. This was one of Iran's proposals in the Shanghai Economic Committees, and is the same case with BRICS. We'll use currencies in our trade which are not willing to limit their worldview to the U.S. power, such as the yuan or the ruble. We'll try to establish our own banking institutions, our own financial institutions in the countries with which we do business, so we can use the opportunity of bilateral settlement. Branches of Iranian banks or joint banks are one of the ideas that are carried out in this regard. Of course, the reality is that the Americans spare no pains to sanction Iran. To this end, they try to identify financial institutions that are somehow dependent on Iran and put them under pressure and we are forced not to have complete transparency for some of these matters. This transparency exists for Iran's internal system. It means that Iranian government institutions know what path they should follow. But there is not an international possibility for it. Any company that wants to do trade with Iran, as it is doing right now, $130 billion trade is not possible without international cooperation. But its condition is that this cooperation should not be announced publicly because the pressure of the Americans and the Zionists exists. Anti-Iranian lobbies to impose sanctions on them. But beyond all these, Iranians have achieved this ability as masters of circumventing sanctions. In many of the countries that we are dealing with today, there are more than 20 countries in the world that have been subjected to unilateral U.S. sanctions. They do business with Iran and try to use Iranian methods so that we can have this trade. The truth is that the Americans have reduced the impact of the weapon of sanctions by using it excessively. Nowadays, a business space has been formed outside the U.S. sanctions environment, which is worth several hundred billion dollars. And surely all these countries that are unjustly under sanctions are using this space, and it is developing with the current trend. Everyone in the world has understood that the Americans use the tool of the dollar for dominance, not for trade. And it is not without reason that they are extremely worried when, for example, Saudi Arabia and China want to do their business with the yuan, or when they hear that the ruble develops in the Commonwealth countries' trade. They are highly sensitive to it. This is perhaps the Americans' lack of long-term strategic understanding, that they do not know that excessive use of sanctions turns it into an ineffective tool. Surely those who follow international issues more closely have seen the U.S. Treasury's report about the failure of sanctions 2 years ago. Today, this tool is becoming a challenge for the Americans themselves. Therefore, we in the Parliament welcome the approaches that help to remove the dollar from Iran's trade. We try to trade with countries that are willing to buy Iranian products. We buy their products too. This way, we can balance our international trade from cryptocurrencies, clearing mechanisms, to local currencies. We use all these tools to be able to develop our own international trade. Pursuing the strengthening of diplomacy has been one of the priorities of the Parliament. That is, economic diplomacy is being discussed jointly in three commissions of the Parliament: the Foreign Policy, the Economic, and Industry Commissions. Our request from our government is to use the tool of diplomacy for the development of international trade. Excellent measures have been taken in this regard, but we think that Iran's trade capacity is more than this. In our surrounding region alone, more than $1,000 billion trade takes place annually, and perhaps Iran's share is very small. Some evaluations show between 3% and 4%. We think that our capacity is more than that, and one of the demands we have of our government is to follow up on this issue.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time, on Insight.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Limelight.
According to experts, American banks are currently under a lot of pressure because of withdrawal of deposits, weak customer confidence, faltering lending, and rising interest rates. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Financial Times has covered this story and tells us more. Trading has halted amid continued uncertainty among investors in the United States as two more U.S. banks collapse. Pacific Western Bank, based in Arizona, and the Los Angeles-based Western Alliance Bank Corporation saw trading of their shares suspended by regulators on Thursday, 4th of May, amid the worst crisis to hit the country's financial sector since the Great Recession. Shares of Pacific Western plunged on Thursday as its stock slumped more than 40% in afternoon trading, dropping to a record low. The bank had confirmed an earlier Reuters report on Wednesday, 3rd of May, that it was exploring strategic options, including a potential sale or capital raising. The Financial Times reported that Western Alliance was also exploring strategic options after its shares paired losses after plummeting by nearly 60%. Earlier this year, Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank collapsed, sending shockwaves through the U.S. banking sector and the wider U.S. economy. First Republic Bank was next in line amid continued uncertainty among investors about the safety of holding their money in U.S. banks. Many countries across the globe have all lost confidence in the U.S. banking sector and decided to join in on a trend in international business commonly known as de-dollarization, cancelling the global dependency on the US dollar in cross-border trade. In contrast to the global anti-US trend, the country's Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell on Wednesday, 3rd of May, reiterated the US banking system remained resilient despite the current strains on it. However, Citigroup banking analyst said, the risk of a bank run or rung on the bank remains high for now. Citigroup analysts wrote in a note to investors, the U.S. Federal Reserve, of course, would react if a chaotic outflow of deposits from regional banks resumes. That risk is more elevated after recent banking developments and can never be fully taken off the table. English website of Al Jazeera Television Network has also covered this story and tells us more. Uncertainty continued to pummel the banking industry despite assurances from financial regulators and bankers such as Jamie Dimon that the worst of the recent crisis is over and the health of the banking sector remains strong. Shares of smaller regional lenders such as Pacific Western Bank plunged nearly 50% on Thursday, 4th of May, after the company confirmed reports that it was considering strategic options that may include the possible sale of the company. Pacific Western said in a statement that it was not experiencing any out-of-ordinary deposit withdrawals and still plans on selling some assets to free up cash on its balance sheet. With $44 billion in assets, Pacific Western is roughly one-fifth of the size of the three regional banks that failed over the past 2 months, that is Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and the First Republic Bank. The bank experienced significant deposit outflows after Silicon Valley Bank failed in mid-March, but said deposits have increased since 31st of March, including its venture banking division, which serves technology and startup companies. Still, investors fear that Pacific Western's fate could mirror that of another California bank, the First Republic Bank, which spent weeks looking for a buyer before failing recently. The regional banks that have run into trouble have seen heavy outflows of deposits and need to raise cash. Nearly all have large amounts of low-interest bonds and commercial real estate assets on their books and would record losses if they sold them on the open market. healthier banks have been reluctant to step in to buy struggling lenders. All assets of Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and First Republic Bank were bought after regulators seized these institutions, and their remnants were transferred to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC. In another sign of potential trouble for the banking industry, a major deal was called off on Thursday, 4th of May. TD Bank Group and First Horizon Corporation said they called off a planned merger, citing regulatory hurdles. Toronto Dominion Bank had said in February that it was buying regional bank First Horizon in a $13.4 billion all-cash deal. Western Alliance shares were among the most volatile and were down 39% when trading was halted. The Phoenix, Arizona-based bank put out a statement overnight saying it has not experienced any unusual withdrawals and its plans to readjust its balance sheet were underway. On Thursday morning, 4th of May, the Financial Times reported that the bank was also considering strategic options. The bank strongly denied the report. The Associated Press has also covered this story and tells us more. Nearly half of Americans are losing their faith in the banking sector after the U.S. banking system faced a series of blows that was an eerie reminder of the 2008 financial crisis. According to a recent Gallup opinion poll, 48% of the American public are concerned about the safety of their funds and deposits in banks or other financial institutions. According to the data, about 19% reported feeling very concerned, and 29% of the American public said they were moderately worried. The survey was conducted a month after Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank came crashing down in March, marking some of the biggest bank failures in U.S. history. However, the opinion poll was taken before regulators seized the troubled First Republic Bank recently, which marked the second largest bank failure in U.S. history. Still, the latest data gathered was similar to the level of concern Americans expressed during the 2008 financial crisis, which was the last time that Gallup gauged Americans' worry of the banking system. According to Gallup, in September of 2008, after Lehman Brothers crashed, still the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history, 45% of American adults expressed that they were either very or moderately worried about the safety of their funds and deposits in banks. According to the data, those most concerned about the safety of their money following the recent failures are lower-income American adults, those without a college degree, and also those who support the Republican Party. Gallup noted that this could be because they are dissatisfied with the current administration of President Joe Biden and the current economic climate in America, or because they are unfamiliar with Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC's insurance.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Sudan and one entire month of intense fighting there between the country's army and a paramilitary group known as Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. As the conflict entered its fourth week on Saturday, airstrikes battered the capital, Khartoum. Warplanes were seen bombing targets, with witnesses saying the fighter jets pounded various parts of the city. That caused telecommunication services to be cut off for hours. Forces loyal to both groups, the army led by Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and RSF leader Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, are fighting intense street battles as well. This is Burhan and Dagalo are engaged in a power struggle over the RSF's integration into the regular army. While the deadly battle rages on in Sudan, the two forces have sent their delegations to Saudi Arabia for talks with the aim of bringing a devastating conflict to an end. The army confirmed that it had sent envoys to Saudi Arabia to discuss what it called details of a truce with its paramilitary foes. The RSF also confirmed that its delegation is present in Saudi Arabia for talks. Meanwhile, the United States and Saudi Arabia have issued a joint statement confirming direct talks between the warring sides in the Saudi city of Jeddah. The statement welcomed the start of the talks and called for a sustainable global effort to quell fighting. The negotiations in Jeddah are the first such serious attempts to end the battle. Numerous ceasefires have so far failed to bring what is regarded as a civil war in Sudan to a halt. The fighting has brought much of the country's vital infrastructure to the brink of collapse, with people across the northeastern African nation struggling to provide their basic needs. Heavy gunfire and deadly airstrikes have already prompted so many countries to withdraw their citizens and nationals from Sudan. Saudi Arabia, Egypt, France, Turkey, and the Netherlands are among those which have already evacuated their citizens from Sudan. Some others have suspended their operations amid heavy fighting there. The deadly conflict in Sudan comes as global organizations have warned of an imminent human catastrophe there. According to a non-governmental organization specializing in disaggregated conflict data collection, the war in Sudan has so far killed around 700 people, mostly in Khartoum and the western Darfur region. Some other organizations have sounded the alarm over the number of children being impacted by the war. On Friday, the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, expressed concern that the situation in Sudan has become fatal for a frighteningly large number of children. UNICEF has said nearly 200 children were killed and about 1,700 wounded only during the first 11 days of the conflict. UNICEF says the actual number could be much higher. The sad part of the story, though, is that some countries have warned that they expect the conflict to continue for a long time. The International Organization for Migration says so far nearly 450,000 civilians have already fled their homes since the fighting began. That includes more than 115,000 who have sought refuge in neighboring countries like Chad. In the meantime, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says it is preparing for an outflow of 860,000 people. Those figures clearly show the magnitude of the tragedy there, with many saying the conflict has exacerbated the already dire humanitarian situation, hunger and malnutrition included. The United Nations has warned that if the fighting rages on between the two forces, it could raise the number of Sudanese threatened by hunger by as many as 2.5 million. Given all the disappointing figures, the ceasefire negotiations in Saudi Arabia have raised hopes not only for millions of Sudanese throughout the country, but for many in the region and around the globe that the conflict could end soon. This not only will save the lives of people who are grappling with years of unrest and uprisings throughout the past decades or so, but would also bring relief to the people of the world who do not want to see another genocidal conflict. But if the warring sides fail to come up with a sustainable solution during the talks, it will be hard to imagine what will be waiting for the people of Sudan.
The sounding bell at the U.S. stock market, symbolic of a stock market that should be performing well. But these cheers are not reflective of what is going on in the U.S. economy. Instead, warning signs should be going off due to the U.S. banking sector. Trading was halted in shares of two more U.S. lenders. Regulators had to step in after PacWest and Western Alliance shares plunged. Although there was optimism in Wall Street after stocks, like in the banking sector, jumped Friday, following a good jobs report and strong Apple earnings, there were still fears and worries about the sector after the failure of four mid-sized banks since early March. Bank customers and investors feared a repeat of other bank failures in the U.S., like First Republic, SVB, and Signature. And those fears are justified. As many as 16 mid-sized banks have shed more than $57 billion in market value since last Friday. American regulators seized then-sold First Republic Bank to J.P. Morgan Chase on Monday, marking the second-largest ever U.S. bank collapse and the third major bank shutdown nationwide in the past 2 months, following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank, or SVB, and Signature Bank.
Today, the Federal Reserve issued its long-awaited report on the cause of the Silicon Valley Bank failure. And while it put the failure squarely in the hands of management and its board for failing to oversee a safe and sound business plan, the Fed did put some heat on itself that its own bank regulators did not respond quickly enough and forcefully enough to conditions on the ground. And these conditions also are conditions that First Republic faced.
The question that is being raised once again is, are we witnessing a repeat of the U.S. financial crisis? Since 2001, more than 500 banks across the U.S. have closed. Most happened after the 2008 financial crisis. Of all the banks that closed since 2001, the largest was Washington Mutual, which closed in September 2008, during the early stages of the financial crisis. The closure of First Republic is the second largest bank closure in the U.S., and the largest since the end of the financial crisis. But this is what stands out for those that believe that there is another financial crisis in the making. About 70 banks across the U.S. have closed over the past decade. The total assets of the three banks closed this year has exceeded the total assets of the 25 banks that closed in 2008, meaning that the scale of U.S. bank closures in 2023 is the largest in years.
In this case, you had a group of banks here that did not plan well for interest rate risk. They did not plan well for big growth, explosive growth. They didn't plan for what they should be planning for, and that's a liquidity event where you have more than ordinary numbers of withdrawals, especially given their levels of uninsured deposits. That's a problem. And so, you know, the chickens have kind of come home to roost for all of these banks.
As seen here, the three banks, namely First Republic, Silicon Valley Bank, and Signature Bank, held a total of $532 billion in assets. That is more than the $526 billion, when adjusted for inflation, held by the 25 banks that collapsed in 2008 at the height of the global financial crisis. There are major factors that are affecting the health of U.S. banks. One of them are the recent Fed hikes. In March of this year, a study jointly released by economists from multiple universities in the U.S. showed that the Fed's rate hike greatly increased the vulnerability of the U.S. banking system.
Fed, just as they were stubborn and obstinate on the idea that inflation was transitory, they're being stubborn and obstinate on the idea that they need to hit 2% inflation before they let up on the tightening. And that's simply just history doesn't bear it out. And unless and until they come to that realization by studying history, you're going to see more and more of these situations.
Affected by the Federal Reserve's aggressive interest rate hikes, the value of financial assets like bonds held by many U.S. banks has shrunk sharply, and the asset value of some banks has even decreased by more than 20%. According to the study, if market confidence continues to weaken and more depositors withdraw their deposits, as many as 186 banks may become insolvent and face the risk of closure. That should be a major concern for the Fed and the man on top, the U.S. President Joe Biden. Another item of concern for the U.S. administration is the U.S. debt ceiling. As it stands, the Biden administration remains at odds with Republicans who have refused to increase the debt ceiling.
Our MAGA Republicans in Congress are threatening to undo all this progress by letting us, quote, default on the debt unless we agree to their demands. The two are totally unrelated.
Whether you pay the debt or not doesn't have a damn thing to do with what your budget is. What your budget is. Where you're going to spend money. How you're going to raise the money. What are you going to cut? What are you going to... They're two separate issues.
If the debt ceiling, which has reached its peak of $31.4 trillion, is not raised, that could potentially lead to a government shutdown on June 1st. The U.S. government reaction so far, in terms of an intervention, has been subdued. The Sentry says even though U.S. banks are failing, it is reported that U.S. authorities are unlikely to intervene. The reason given? Regional lenders, such as PacWest and Western Alliance, are not seen as systemically important, and more consolidation is predicted to be ahead. The outlook, however, looks bleak. Unless the Fed rides to the rescue with cuts in interest rates, the options are amalgamation, regulation, or more banks going bust. The response of the U.S. authorities suggests little appetite for a laissez-faire approach. While the U.S. is struggling with these economic issues, it is also facing the prospects of de-dollarization, which is uncontrollable since many countries are queuing up to wean their economy off the dollar. Russia has accused Ukraine of attacking the Kremlin with drones in a failed assassination attempt to kill President Vladimir Putin, vowing retaliation for what it has called a terrorist attack. Moscow has said the two drones were used in the alleged attack on Putin's residence in the Kremlin's citadel overnight, adding that the drones were disabled by electronic defenses.
It is technically possible. Ukraine has several types of drones that can fit the profile. For example, its newly developed UJ-22 drone can actually fly the distance. It's a commercial drone that they acquired from China. It's Mugin 5 cargo drone, which can be basically purchased online and could be refitted into a military drone. That drone can fly several hundred kilometers, and it was used in previous attacks.
Kremlin statement said, "We regard these actions as a planned terrorist act and an attempt on the president's life carried out on the eve of Victory Day, the May 9 parade, at which the presence of foreign guests is also planned."
And of course, attacks of this kind, if they are in fact carried by Ukrainian military, are meant to keep the Russian military off balance by forcing them to reallocate and rededicate air defense resources to specific places like Moscow, probably at the expense of other regions, including, for example, Russian military inside Ukraine proper, that has to have enough air defense and electronic warfare protection.
Separately, the Speaker of Russia's parliament demanded the use of, quote, weapons capable of stopping and destroying the Kiev terrorist regime, response to the alleged attack on Kremlin. However, Ukraine denied any involvement in the alleged drone operation. Kiev has said the attack was, quote, staged by Moscow.
The Russians may try to leverage this narrative around an assassination on Putin to then up their game with regards to pretext to up their game to go after Zelensky himself. But they've been trying to do that anyway since the beginning of the war. There's plenty of reporting that indicates Russian kind of kill teams were out there trying to hunt down both Zelensky and his family. So it's mainly, I think, a rally around the flag effect that the Russians are going for.
Meanwhile, Ukraine says Russia has targeted cities in a new wave of missile strikes and shelling across the country. Officials and media outlets say multiple explosions were heard in the capital, Kiev, and elsewhere. Blasts caused by Russian shelling were also reported in the southern Zaporizhzhia region and the port city of Odessa. Kiev and some central and eastern Ukrainian regions have announced air alerts following the Russian statement accusing Ukraine of attacking the Kremlin. There are now some reports that Ukrainian forces have begun their counterattack in Bakhmut. Russian officials have said Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russia will have no benefit and will only lead to more bloodshed. The U.S. and its allies have put much hope in the offensive. However, leaked documents show Western military officials do not expect Ukraine to regain as much territory. Ukrainian forces have also been using lots of manpower and other resources fighting in Bakhmut. The intensifying crisis comes amid fresh U.S. military aid to Ukraine. The U.S. is sending another $300 million military aid package to Ukraine, including, for the first time, short-range air-launched rockets, deepening its involvement in the war in defiance of repeated warnings by Russia. The package includes Hydra-70 rockets, which are unguided projectiles fired from aircraft. It also includes artillery rounds, 155-millimeter howitzer cannons, anti-tank missiles, and mortars. The Pentagon has also sent at least 20 high-mobility artillery rocket systems, HIMARS, to Ukraine. HIMARS systems, which are made by Lockheed Martin, are intended to be a core component of Ukraine's fighting force in the future. The package brings the total amount of U.S. military aid to about $36 billion. The U.S. is still drawing funds for military assistance to Ukraine from the $45 billion aid package that Congress authorized in December.
Running against Russia, being nasty to Russia, is very popular. But I'll tell you what's not popular. More than 60% of the American people do not like all the money we're spending on Ukraine. And the American media is not reporting that, and it's also not reporting that there's demonstrations are going every weekend in Europe, particularly in Germany. There's a lot of demonstrations, not about the pipeline, against the war, the money that's being spent on Ukraine, and the whole notion of that war, and the whole rationale for the war. And you can almost understand why Biden wanted to keep Germany from having the option to open the pipeline.
The $45 billion is expected to be exhausted by the summer, meaning the White House might ask Congress more funds soon. The U.S. and its Western allies have kept feeding Ukraine with massive amounts of arms since the start of the war last year. Moscow has time and again warned that military assistance will only prolong the war.
A well-known resistance actor within the Palestinian prisoners movement, Hador Adnan, has passed away on the 86th day of his hunger strike inside an Israeli prison following two decades of arrests. Hador spent nearly a fifth of his life behind bars, arrested 12 times by Israeli forces and subjected to over 8 years of captivity. He used hunger strikes to take power back and mobilize the world outside his prison cell in support of the Palestinian prisoners' struggle. Sustained arbitrary arrests and medical neglect led to Khadr's death. The Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council thus viewed Khadr's killing as premeditated murder by the Israeli regime. Israeli prison services were holding Khadr in solitary confinement and refused his family visitation rights right up to his death. He survived by his wife and 9 children. In his lifetime, Hador Adnan carried out 6 hunger strikes. His first protest in 2004 lasted 25 days and popularized hunger strikes as an accessible means of resistance within the regime's military prison system. His second hunger strike in 2012, that lasted 66 days, was joined by hundreds of prisoners and triggered an international movement for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners. In 2015, he went on his third hunger strike for 56 days against another administrative detention. In 2017, Khadr was again arrested and went on a 58-day hunger strike. His fifth 25-day-long strike was directed at his penultimate arrest in 2021. During his most recent arrest in February, Israeli forces raided his home and terrorized his family. Khadr was no stranger to civil disobedience, therefore responded by immediately going on an open hunger strike. Israeli prison services retaliated with isolation orders, renewed every 2 weeks without review. He was held under deplorable conditions and was subjected to regular abuses. When Khadr fell seriously ill in April, ISP refused to transfer him to a hospital. Khadr was found unconscious in isolation in Ramallah Prison Clinic on May 2nd. Using deliberate medical neglect, indefinite isolation, and detention extensions, the regime foresaw and facilitated Khadr's death. He was killed behind the bars, a fate shared by over 233 Palestinian political prisoners. The international community's failure to intervene amplifies past evidence that international law is just a tool for the colonizer regime of Israel, not Palestinians. It shows that the international community aids and abets the Israeli regime's crimes by its deafening silence that today rings loud after the death of Hador Adnan. Palestinians rallied in Gaza City as shops closed during a general strike following the death of Palestinian hunger striker Hador Adnan in Israeli custody. In his hometown near Jenin, in the occupied West Bank, Adnan's 9-year-old son, Ali, led a protest march.
Yeah.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya described the death of Adnan, who was arrested in the occupied West Bank, as a deliberate assassination.
The Palestinian cabinet holds the Israeli occupation, the prison authorities and all its agencies fully accountable for the martyrdom of Qadir Adnan. And we consider this a deliberate assassination by rejecting his request for release, neglecting him medically and keeping him in his cell despite the seriousness of his health condition.
Also, different Palestinian factions held the regime responsible for his death, saying that Israel will pay dearly for its crime.
The occupation bears full responsibility, and we will carry out our role in confronting those crimes and those assaults, in particular this crime which led to the martyrdom of Sheikh Hero Qadir Adnan.
Gaza-based Hamas resistance movement has also warned that the Israeli crime will not go unanswered. Also, the Fatah movement of President Mahmoud Abbas has called for immediate international action in support of Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails. According to Palestinian Prisoner Society, 4,900 Palestinian detainees are currently in Israeli jails, with 1,000 of them being held in administrative detention without charge. That's the highest number since 2003.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
WHO's Director General has recently said the COVID-19 pandemic has been on a downward trend, but the risk of new variants remain. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Nature wrote in this regard, the World Health Organization, WHO, announced recently that COVID-19 is no longer a public health emergency of international concern, or PHEIC. WHO's Director General Tedros Adhanom made the decision following a recommendation by the organization's COVID-19 Emergency Committee. During a meeting, the committee highlighted the decreasing trend in deaths and hospitalizations and the high levels of population immunity against SARS-CoV-2 as reasons for ending the PHEIC. During a press conference the following day, Tedros emphasized that COVID-19 remains a global health threat and said that the new status doesn't mean that countries should let down their guard. It's time for countries to transition from emergency mode to managing COVID-19 alongside other infectious diseases, he said. The announcement didn't come as a surprise. After the Emergency Committee's last meeting in late January, Tedros acknowledged that the pandemic was probably at a transition point. This is not a snap decision. It is a decision that has been considered carefully for some time, planned for, and made on the basis of a careful analysis of the data, he said during the press conference. A PHEIC defined by the WHO as an extraordinary event that constitutes a public health risk to other countries through the international spread of disease is the highest level of international public health alarm. The COVID-19 PHEIC was declared on January 30, 2020. In practice, this decision compelled countries to start reporting cases to the WHO to create worldwide surveillance. Importantly, it's signaling to all countries that they need to prepare for it, says epidemiologist Salim Abdul-Karim, the director of the Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa in Durban. In the 3 years, 3 months, and 5 days that have passed since the PHEIC was first established, countries reported 7 million deaths to the WHO. Estimates from the WHO and others as to the pandemic's true death toll are 2 to 3 times higher. There are no hard and fast rules to determine when a PHEIC is over, says Karim, adding, we are still very much in a pandemic. We are just in a different stage in which we are no longer seeing large numbers of deaths and pressure on hospitals. He added, for Karim, the end of PHEIC is a recognition that SARS-CoV-2 will be around for a long time. But although he says the decision was pragmatic and reasonable, he worries that it will mean in terms of resources and availability of diagnostic tests, vaccination and treatment. Epidemiologist Jennifer Nuzzo, the director of the Pandemic Center at the Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, says it is unclear whether this decision will have much practical impact, given that many countries have already been relaxing their measures to combat COVID-19. Nuzzo says political attention to the pandemic was lost long before the decision, unfortunately. Even while COVID remains a top cause of death, governments have decided to put their energies elsewhere. Nuzzo says it's important to distinguish between the end of the PHEIC and the decision by individual countries to end their public health emergencies. The United States, for example, announced that its COVID-19 health emergency will end on May 11th. That means U.S. residents will lose access to free COVID-19 testing, vaccines, and treatment. Karim says, so it will worsen the inequity in the access to diagnostics, treatments, and then that's my concern. In his statement, Tedros said he also decided to establish a review committee to develop long-term recommendations for countries on how to manage COVID-19 going forward. The WHO published an updated version of their strategic preparedness and response plan for COVID-19, outlining actions that countries should take in the next 2 years. Nuzzo says what is most urgent now is to make sure that countries don't turn back on trying to learn the lessons of COVID and bolster their preparedness for future pandemics. In the meantime, according to Science, Greg Gonzalez, a public health expert at the Yale School of Public Health, says he's less concerned about what to call the pandemic than what is done to address it. Regardless of whether it is called a PHEIC, COVID-19 continues to cause death and suffering across the globe, he says, adding, yet almost everywhere we've declared mission accomplished and we have no appetite for doing anything more to fight this disease. Gonzalez says, we are willing to bake in a huge amount of morbidity and mortality to get back to normal, and it doesn't bode well for facing our future.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. All praises due to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and upon his pure progeny, particularly the vestige of God, remaining on earth. My expectation from this meeting was that the talks would be well-founded and presented using a proper literature, and praise God, this is what happened. I might not agree with some of the things you have said, but I am very happy with the quality of your talks and the organization of the content, and I am thankful to God for this. Well, it is the end of the month of Ramadan. You have had the opportunity to sit down, think, study, and organize your content. If there were time, I wouldn't mind if another 10 people spoke too. However, we are gradually approaching the time for breaking the fast, and the things I have to say in our meeting would be left unfinished. Before I begin, I would like to say a couple of things about the same things that you spoke about. First of all, a number of people sent their greetings to me. I would like to ask you to send my greetings to the brothers and sisters who asked you to send their greetings to me, especially the families of the martyrs. As for my birthday, it really isn't worthy of consideration. It is a very small and insignificant event.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Some matters were stated as complaints, problems, and recommendations, which should be discussed. So where should these things be discussed? They are not very clear or definite. They can be broken down and discussed. It seems to me that we transfer your suggestions to the planning and budget organization, in which some new activity has started, so they can attend to them. This would be a good approach. You can convey what has been said to them, or we can. Our office can act as a mediator and convey these talks to them and ask you to go there and discuss things with them. God willing, you will come to an acceptable common conclusion. Regarding the issue of privatization, which some friends mentioned here and which was repeated, and the same is being said outside, the logic that you used is incorrect. They took some wrong actions. Well, yes, any good law can be applied incorrectly. If we hand over the country's facilities, its production facilities, its factories, all these things that were operating smoothly, if we hand them over to the government, the government will not be able to manage production facilities and large production companies. Allah, I wanna
Jukebox.